We've got the latest on Boeing, what an aging workforce means for the economy, and a big deal in big wine. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. From the studios of Colorado Public Radio in Denver, I'm Amy Scott, in for Kai Rizdahl. It's Thursday, April 4th. Good to have you with us. The Ethiopian government is out with a preliminary report on an airline crash last month that killed all 157 people on board. It was the second crash involving a Boeing 737 MAX in 5 months. The report finds that the crew on the Ethiopian Airlines flight followed all the procedures provided by Boeing, but still weren't able to control the plane. Marketplace's Jack Stewart has been looking into what comes next for Boeing as it continues to work on a fix and try to restore the faith of the flying public.
Ethiopian investigators looked at data from flight ET-302's onboard recorders. The data shows the plane dove hard several times before hitting the ground.
This doesn't look good for Boeing. I think this hurts them even more.
Sean Prajnicki is at the Center for Aviation Studies at Ohio State University. He says the findings renew the focus on Boeing's MCAS system, a flight control program designed to push the nose of the big-engined 737 MAX down to prevent a disastrous stall. Full investigations of both Boeing 737 MAX crashes could take a year. Investigators are also looking at physical evidence from recovered wreckage. That's a skill that's taught in this Los Angeles warehouse, filled with twisted metal, broken glass, and torn cables.
And here we have the wreckage of 12 crashed airplanes.
Thomas Anthony at the University of Southern California uses these wrecks to train investigators from around the world to look at the positions of flap actuators or to read broken gauges.
Let's take a look at this central control column here.
Anthony is a former safety official with the FAA. He's not involved in either the Lion Air or Ethiopian cases, but says investigators have to look at Boeing's entire organizational culture.
Well, this is a very important investigation because if we just focus on the mechanical defects of the 737 MAX, we will not get to the root cause.
Boeing's already working on a software update and other fixes for the 737 MAX. Jim Corridor at CFRA Research says the company's doing what it can to restore confidence in its aircraft.
They did a test flight with the CEO, Dennis Muilenburg, on board and with the new software in place, and it does seem to be working.
Muilenburg said today, quote, "It's our responsibility to eliminate this risk. We own it and we know how to do it." Getting that software fix certified by regulators is still likely several weeks away, though. I'm Jack Stewart for Marketplace.
Tomorrow is Jobs Day, when we'll get the Labor Department's monthly employment report for March, which will give us some indication of how strong the economy is right now. For the longer view, the Economic Innovation Group, a Washington think tank, is out with a new report showing a worrisome trend for the future. The report says most U.S. counties are facing an unprecedented demographic crisis. Marketplace's Mitchell Hartman has more.
If you live in one of America's vibrant cities, you probably don't see much of the demographic trend that John Lettieri of the Economic Innovation Group does for the whole country.
The population is growing at its slowest pace since the Great Depression.
Blame a declining birth rate and a slowdown in immigration. Lettieri's study found that in 80% of U.S. counties, the number of prime-age adults actually declined from 2007 to 2017.
About half of the country's population are seeing the cornerstone of their local economies, that prime-age workforce, actually shrink.
In the past, the flow of immigrants to the U.S. has been a major source of new workers, but that spigot's being turned down, says economist Ray Perryman in Waco, Texas. He sees the consequences all around.
Homes not being built. The shrimping season basically was shut down because of raids on the workforce. It really has some dramatic effects on construction, on agriculture, on the hospitality industry.
Employers could invest in more technology and automation, but Aparna Matter at the American Enterprise Institute says that's not going to work for a lot of jobs.
When you especially talk about low-skill jobs, a lot of them actually need people to be there. Those are harder to replace by machines.
The Economic Innovation Group, which is supported in part by investors and entrepreneurs, is proposing a new heartland visa to bring skilled immigrant workers to parts of the country that are depopulating. I'm Mitchell Hartman for Marketplace.
On Wall Street, a little up, a little down. We'll have details when we do the numbers. It's been a year and a half since President Trump declared opioid addiction a national health emergency, one that has cost the nation hundreds of thousands of lives and billions of dollars over the past few decades, with no end in sight. That's why for the past year, Marketplace's podcast, The Uncertain Hour, has been reporting in Wise County, Virginia, in the heart of Appalachia. In one small town there recently, there were five times as many opioid prescriptions as people. The question the Uncertain Hour team is tackling this season, how do drug epidemics ever end? Marketplace's Caitlin Ash rode along with a police officer who, for more than a decade now, has been struggling just to contain his town's drug problem.
Bucky Culbertson is riding shotgun in a big black truck with tinted windows. He's an undercover narcotics investigator with the Southwest Virginia Drug Task Force.
It's really hard to work undercover in this area because so many people do learn about you. So you have to be
there are just 40,000 people in Wise County. So far, Bucky's cover hasn't been blown, but there are a lot of rumors about his disguises, like he wears wigs. Bucky denies that. He does change his clothes three or four times a day, and his facial hair. At the moment, he has a goatee, and he's wearing sunglasses and a hat. We're driving on these windy mountain roads in Wise County.
No guardrails.
To a tiny town named Appalachia.
Used to, this town would be completely full of nothing but coal trucks going and coming.
There are a lot fewer of those trucks now, and there's a lot less tax money from coal coming in to support the county, just about a tenth of what it was a decade ago. The population has been declining, too, and drugs have been flooding in. We drive past a doctor's office.
This is the office here.
It's a small red brick building just off Main Street.
Appalachian Medical Clinic.
The cops raided it a few weeks earlier. The doctor was charged with more than 100 counts of illegal drug distribution, prescription fraud, Medicaid fraud, and more. Bucky says taking down just one clinic can interrupt the supply for dozens, even hundreds of small-time dealers. But those busts come with a downside. As sources for pain pills dry up, other drugs like heroin and methamphetamine move in to fill the void.
There's a lot of crystal meth in here, in this area.
It's funny because it just looks like a sleepy...
It's not. They're just not awake yet.
Bucky says meth is cheaper on the street than it's ever been. The price has dropped by about half in just a few months. He spends a lot of time trying to buy drugs that way and work his way up the chain to bigger dealers.
Well, if you're going to prosecute the devil, you got to go to hell to get the witnesses. That's just kind of the way we have to look at it.
Bucky Culbertson is 42, and he hasn't always been a cop. In fact, you can almost trace the booms and busts of Wise County through his career. He started driving coal trucks straight out of high school.
Best job I ever had.
Really?
Yeah, I love it.
Why? Why was it the best job?
Just peaceful. Looked at the mountains and hum of that motor. It was dangerous, but it was fun.
But he got laid off a few years later in the late 90s, so he started a lumber business with his dad. At its peak, they had about 20 employees. But times have changed. As Bucky shows me around the old sawmill, he points to the lone remaining worker, his 62-year-old dad, driving a loader in the distance.
I wanted to hang it all up. My father wanted to hang on to it, and so we hung on to it partially. But if it had been left up to me, there wouldn't be nothing here.
What did the business in wasn't globalization or regulations.
Pain pills, yeah, at that time.
Bucky couldn't find workers, or at least sober workers. They'd show up the first few days okay, but soon they'd be...
falling asleep while standing up, irritable, or just not showing up.
And it wasn't just his workers who were getting hooked on pain pills. It was his high school friends, too. So in 2005, Bucky left lumber behind and started a third career, fighting the very forces that were destroying his business, his town, and people he'd known his entire life.
All I wanted to do was work narcotics because of all my friends that have overdosed and died, or they're living in poverty because of that addictions. It affects you. It does.
Like many rural areas, the responsibility for fighting the drug crisis here has landed on law enforcement. The county prosecutor's office says the vast majority of felony cases somehow relate back to drugs or alcohol. One day, while we were talking with some prosecutors, Bucky told me a story about a guy he dealt with recently.
And he said, well, putting me in jail for 5 years ain't going to rehabilitate me. And I said, listen, pal, we don't care about rehabilitating you at this point. We just, the neighbors have got to have some relief. He was like, well, darn. But that's kind of where we get at it is, you know, I don't care if it helps you. I don't care if it benefits you. I've got to have some relief.
But the county still pays the price. The regional jail is only 14 years old, and it's already had to build an extension because the inmate population has more than doubled. And Wise County's spending on the jail has tripled in the past decade. Bucky says it's a revolving door. The same people get arrested, get released, and wind up back in jail. I asked him one day this question we've been asking everyone for this series. How do you stop a drug epidemic?
I don't know. I really don't. Not a clue. I've said it over and over, we can't arrest our way out of this. It's just not going to happen. We just put a Band-Aid on it. That's it.
But until recently, that Band-Aid was pretty much the only resource available in Wise County and in lots of communities across the country. I'm Caitlin Esch for Marketplace.
If law enforcement alone can't stop a drug epidemic, what's a rural community to do? Wise County is experimenting with some controversial new ideas. Subscribe to The Uncertain Hour to hear more. You can get it wherever you get your podcasts. Coming up,
we lost our higher speed rail in a competition with airlines and also with auto trips.
The slow progress of high speed rail in California. But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Jones Industrial Average rose 166 points, 0.6%, to close at 26,384. The NASDAQ lost 3 points, essentially flat, to finish at 7,891. And the S&P 500 found 5 points, 0.2%, to end at 2,879. Tesla shares reversed 8.2%. The company announced it delivered fewer cars than Wall Street expected during the first quarter. Facebook picked up 1.4% after Guggenheim Partners upgraded the stock. It said shareholders are getting accustomed to Facebook's privacy issues. Target says it will raise its minimum hourly wage by $1 to $13. Target rose 2.6%. Bonds rose. The yield on the 10-year T-note fell to 2.50%. And you are listening to Marketplace.
Hey, everybody, it's Kai. I want to tell you about another podcast from Marketplace. It's called The Uncertain Hour. This season goes deep inside the war on drugs because to understand how we've handled the opioid crisis so far, you need to go back in history, starting 30 years ago when President George H.W. Bush held up an actual baggie of crack cocaine during his first national televised speech. There is, though, a strange backstory to where that baggie of crack came from, and it's a moment we've been dealing with ever since. The new season is out now. Listen and subscribe to The Uncertain Hour, wherever you get your podcasts.
This is Marketplace. I'm Amy Scott. Wines like Clos du Bois, Ravenswood, and Estancia are standbys on grocery store shelves, and they're part of a $1.7 billion deal between two major players in the wine industry. Constellation Brands, known for Corona beer, says it plans to sell 30 of its low-priced wine and spirit lines to E&J Gallo, as in Ernest and Julio Gallo. It may be a family-owned business, but that doesn't mean mom and pop. Marketplace's Megan McCarty-Carino reports.
The wine bottles on store shelves seem like little works of art, each with its own unique label and evocative description, you know, notes of bramble with a hint of vanilla spice. You imagine them coming from a rustic farmhouse with rows of tended vines and an obsessive winemaker dedicated to the craft, like the one described by Paul Giamatti's character in the wine snob classic film Sideways.
Only the most patient and nurturing of growers. Only somebody who really takes the time to understand Pinot's potential can then coax it into its fullest expression.
But that's not really how the business works these days, says Rob McMillan, a wine industry analyst with Silicon Valley Bank.
The vast majority of wine that you find in grocery stores, it's made in a production style, and it's not authentic, it's not craft wine, it's mass production wine.
He says the $45 billion wine industry has come to be dominated by Gallo and Constellation and a handful of other major players that together represent about 75% of all wine sales. But sales have been dropping for cheaper wines like those Gallo plans to buy, says Stephen Ronacleve, a beverage industry strategist with Dutch Rabobank.
It is a challenging time for the lower end of the market. People are generally drinking less but better.
But Gallo may see an opportunity with younger consumers in their 20s and early 30s who may just be starting to develop a taste for a glass of wine to pair with their avocado toast. I'm Megan McCarty-Carino for Marketplace.
One of the hardest things for many moms returning to work after the birth of a baby is getting acquainted or reacquainted with a breast pump. Just that topic, breast pumps, may make some of you out there squirm. But frankly, that's part of the problem. Pumping is awkward, time-consuming, often expensive, and nobody really wants to talk about it. Which helps explain why, for many women, the whole experience, and yep, I'm going with the pun, just sucks. Anna North is a senior reporter with Vox.com, where she wrote a story called The Impossible Quest for a Better Breast Pump. Hi, Anna.
Hi, thanks so much for having me.
Anna, describe these contraptions for the uninitiated.
Sure. So for a conventional breast pump, usually, you know, there's a pump unit that's electric. You connect some tubes to it, and then you sort of have this contraption that goes over your breast. And that contraption has a number of parts. They're usually plastic parts, you know, sometimes four or five parts for each breast. And then it's not hands-free. You need a special bra. Sometimes you can make one yourself, but they don't come with the breast pump. So you've got to kind of, you know, figure out your own way to make that work. And then once you've got that all going and you turn it on, it's actually quite loud. So some breast pumps are quieter than others. But, you know, for instance, my job involves a lot of phone calls. So I have all these tapes where you can hear me trying to interview someone and this breast pump is sort of sucking away in the background. So it's not great for a lot of jobs.
I still remember the sound mine made, which was something like, what? Oh, what? Oh, what?
Yeah.
Oh. Not exactly a sound you want in a conference call.
No.
So there have been some innovations, though, in the last couple of years. Tell me about these new wearable devices that are supposed to be a little bit easier to manage.
Yeah, so I was really interested in finding out more about these when I first learned about them, which is definitely while I was breastfeeding and scrolling through Instagram late at night. These new devices, like the Willow, allow you to actually wear it, and there's no tubes, and you can stick it in your bra and have it on. Now, in my experience, would you be comfortable wearing it outside the house at your job? I don't know. They're quite large sometimes. But that's the idea, that you could be walking around and your hands are free and your body's free while you're still pumping.
Tell me about these hackathons that MIT has been doing and whether there is some new investment.
Yeah, so there's starting to be changes in the space, which is exciting. There have now been two hackathons called the Make the Breast Pump Not Suck Hackathon. the second one in particular was interesting because that hackathon chose to really look not just at the pump itself, but everything around pumping. So things like family leave, things like do people have a place to pump, issues that face low-income women and women of color. There's real interest in the space, but there's also a lot of barriers to innovation. One of the barriers, frankly, is that in, you know, the American economy and the tech sector, there hasn't been a lot of attention to the needs of women and particularly to the needs of mothers.
So as more women get involved, maybe we'll see a little bit more research and innovation?
I think that's true. I think, and we're starting to see these now, both with the Willow and with the LV, which also is a wearable pump. But I will also say that I think it's not necessarily enough to make the pump better, although that would help. We are facing, you know, just culturally still this perception that breastfeeding is very important, but it's the mother's job to figure out how to make that work and no one else's job to really support her. And I do think that until that changes, until there's more of a sense that, you know, if we're going to put this priority in breastfeeding, that there ought to be a lot more social supports in place. I think until we get there, it's still going to be hard.
Okay. Anna North wrote about the quest to build a better breast pump at Vox. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
The largest public works project currently underway in the U.S. is California's high-speed rail line. Despite years of setbacks and the recent wrangling between President Trump and California Governor Gavin Newsom over federal funds, the project continues. If completed, it would connect San Francisco to Los Angeles with the country's first bullet train after more than 50 years of U.S. proposals. Marketplace's Ben Bradford reports now on what that history tells us about the future of high-speed rail.
When Amtrak's Coast Starlight pulls away from Union Station in Los Angeles, it takes 12 hours to make it up to San Francisco. But another train once ran the same tracks 2 hours faster, in 1937.
And here's our modern trailblazer, Southern Pacific's swift streamlined Daylight, most beautiful train in America.
The Daylight was a streamliner, a sleeker, faster class of train rail companies introduced in the 1930s. Many hit speeds over 100 miles per hour.
By 1939, the 10 fastest passenger trains in the world were all U.S. streamliners.
Mark Reuter, the retired editor of Railroad History magazine, says the trains competed against the emerging auto industry until, after World War II, under President Eisenhower.
The highway construction program initiated by Ike is the biggest peacetime enterprise ever undertaken.
The U.S. decisively chose asphalt over train tracks. Cities also began building airports, and by 1965, train ridership had fallen 80%.
We lost our higher speed rail in a competition with airlines and also with auto trips.
UC Berkeley transportation professor Elizabeth Deakin says, meanwhile, in 1964, Japan launched the world's first high-speed line, reaching 130 miles per hour, using streamliner technology. President Lyndon Johnson pledged to catch up.
I will ask for funds to study high-speed rail transportation.
This kicked off 50 years of American attempts to build bullet trains.
This is not some fanciful pie-in-the-sky vision of the future. It is now.
President Obama in 2009. As the Great Recession worsened, he signed an economic stimulus package, which included $8 billion for high-speed rail projects, including California's. But Deakin says by this point, U.S. efforts face an additional hurdle other countries don't. Decades of transportation habits.
We fly, they take trains.
France or Italy could upgrade existing lines to make them faster. But when California builds high-speed rail, it starts largely from scratch. Crews are now laying concrete for the first 100 miles of high-speed track through the Central Valley. But the total price to connect L.A. and San Francisco has nearly doubled to $77 billion, leading new Governor Gavin Newsom to question the economics.
The current project, as planned, would cost too much and respectfully take too long.
University of Sydney civil engineering professor David Levinson argues it's not worth spending billions to recreate our passenger rail system because planes and cars actually get us between cities pretty well.
Intercity travel is not generally congested, while urban travel often is. So the question that you have to ask is that the highest priority use of scarce resources.
In other words, California might better apply its rail money to fixing commutes within L.A. and the Bay Area and making it faster to get to the airport. But Jim Cohen, a transportation professor at John Jay College, argues high-speed rail will grow more essential in the future, especially in California.
Given its population growth, given its problems with sustainability, they need this third form of transportation.
That's assuming people will switch to a train. With so few existing rail passengers, it's hard to project ridership, an uncertainty that's pushed other train initiatives off the track. The same year Japan launched its bullet train, the 1964 World's Fair in New York debuted another up-and-comer.
So there you have what many experts say is the train of the future.
Swift. That train of the future? The monorail. I'm Ben Bradford for Marketplace.
We've got a timeline of the fraught history of U.S. attempts at high-speed rail on our website. Head on over to marketplace.org. The this final note on the way out, you may have heard that Burger King started selling an Impossible Whopper this week. It's a meatless burger using plant-based patties made by Impossible Foods. But be careful what you call it in Europe if new food labeling rules come to pass. A committee of the European Parliament voted this week to prohibit companies from using words like burger, steak, and sausage to describe non-meat products. Veggie burgers might be called veggie discs instead. Sausages, tubes. I know, sounds delicious. Cattle producers are pushing for similar restrictions here in the U.S. And that's it for us. We got to go. Today, the Dow rose 166 points, 0.6%. The NASDAQ lost 3 points, essentially flat. The S&P 500 was up 5 points, or 0.2%. Thanks to Brady McNellis here at Colorado Public Radio, Amir Bibawi, John Buckley, Eve Epstein, John Gordon, Heron Bakella, and Betsy Streisand are the Marketplace editing staff. The managing editor is Deirdre Depke, and I'm Amy Scott. Have a great night. We'll be back tomorrow. This is APM.